Hello, my name is Jim O'Neill, and amongst the many things I've done in my life was leading a remarkable review into the challenge of so-called antimicrobial resistance, an independent commission for the Cameron government from 2014 to 2016. And it's resulted in me having many interests in the topic of antimicrobial resistance, in particular the inappropriate and overuse of antibiotics. And in this regard, here today with me is Alistair Hay, a GP and Professor of Primary Care at the University of Bristol. Alistair leads a research group within the Centre for Academic Primary Care, whose main aim is to improve the use of antibiotics in primary care. His group's latest paper reports a world-leading study looking at whether GPs and nurses in primary care used a novel point-of-care test, and when they did, what they thought of it. The paper has just been published in the journal Family Practice, which happens to be one of the world's leading primary care research journals, and it's entitled Novel Multivirus Rapid Respiratory Microbiological Point-of-Care Testing in Primary Care, a Mixed Methods Feasibility Evaluation. Quite a mouthful, but very worth everybody spending time to read. Alistair's co-authors are Dr. Tanzila Khalid, Dr. Lorna Duncan, Dr. Hannah Thornton, Dr. Gemma Lassiter, and Dr. Peter Muir. First up, Alistair, what kind of specific point-of-care test is it?
Okay, so this is very high-tech kit, certainly from a GP perspective. You'd be fiddling around or get the pleasure of playing with this sort of high-tech kit. It's essentially able to analyse the mucus from a throat and nasal swab, and using a limonary chase reaction technology, by the detection, it can detect the presence of 17 common respiratory viruses and 4 atypical respiratory bacteria in 45 minutes. So, or perhaps the first time, it offers the prospect that in primary care, we can move from what feels sometimes like a microbiological dark age into an age where we might even be able to say to a patient that we've got some confidence that their respiratory symptoms, their infection, is due to virus M. And at the moment, we kind of, to be honest, we flannel around a bit. We say, oh, we think it's viral, but to be honest, if anyone pushed very hard to say, well, how do you know it's a virus, we would start to struggle to really offer a sound, robust answer to that question. So here for the first time is the prospect that we can answer that question.
So it's essentially an aid to stop you doctors guessing whether something's viral or not.
Ooh, indeed. And I think, you know, guessing is, at the moment, exactly what we do, hand on heart.
So one of the reasons it's a pleasure for me to do this, as you know, Alistair, amongst the recommendations my review suggested was a dramatically stepped-up use of exactly these kind of diagnostics to have a major impact on cutting the inappropriate use of antibiotics. What it was often said back to me at the time is that the problem is a lot of these point-of-care tests are too expensive. The way you describe this test you suggest or have conducted, I guess, might be quite pricey. What, is it expensive or is it something that's affordable?
It's completely unaffordable at the moment. But then, you know, we are currently using monitors and laptops that 50 years ago would have been completely unaffordable in precisely the same way. So there's little doubt in my mind, and I'm sure in the minds of many, that once this technology is in wider use, its production will be scaled up and the costs will tumble. At the moment, we're looking at sort of £30,000 to £50,000 per machine. So that's wow. way beyond the, you know, the budget of any GP practice, and I'm quite sure any of the CCGs at this stage. And each test costs about £100 to process. So sure, right now, not affordable, but I think, you know, it's really important that we understand where this sort of technology fits into clinical care. Because as the costs start to fall, I'm quite sure that there'll be increasing pressure on us, and rightly so, if it's effective, for us to use this sort of technology. But if it just gets kind of introduced and is seen as a good thing without really being properly evaluated, there's no surprise, you know, you're talking to a professor. The professor is going to say it's got to be properly investigated.
Right. Well, I want to come back to that later, but let's get into some more specifics about the test. Why did you choose this particular type of feasibility study?
Yeah, so we knew we wanted to work up towards doing a randomized controlled trial. As you will know, and many of the listeners to this will know, the only really robust way to assess whether something is an effective use of limited health resources is to subject it to a randomized controlled trial. But what we were concerned to not do was to apply for funding and then give practices this piece of kit that they then didn't use, and it just sat on the side of the bench gathering dust. So we felt the first step was to just give GPs and nurses in primary care the opportunity to interact with this technology. And we said to them, look, you know, use it as you see fit. We gave them very little guidance in the way of what sorts of patients we wanted them to use it in. And so that really gave us, the results therefore give us an insight into the way they might use it in routine care, the first sort of glimpses of how it might be used. And as we'll go on to discuss, you know, they basically really liked it. And they used it in probably about a third of the patients that they were managing with respiratory infections during the time they had the machine. So I think we've demonstrated that it didn't gather dust, and we'd like to think that we're now ready to do that randomized controlled trial.
What was the main aim of the study, and how did you do it?
Yeah, so the main aim was just to see whether they would use it, how frequently they would use it, in what sorts of patients and with what sorts of infections they would use it, what they liked about it, what they didn't like about it, what they would want to see improved. So that was the main aim.
And how did you do it?
So the winter before last, so that takes us back to 1819, we invited a number of practices in the Bristol area to help us. That's just a convenient sample because they're close by. Four said they were very interested to help us, and to each of those practices we gave the machine for 2 months, and we then said, you know, use it as you see fit.
Wow. And what did you find?
So they recruited 93 participants into the study, so they used the kit 93 times. And as I say, that was, they tell us that was in about a third of the patients that they saw during that time period. So they used it quite a lot. The age range was very broad, so they used it in very young children and in the elderly and in everyone in between. And that sort of reflects the burden of this problem to primary care, which is largely young children and the elderly. They're the two groups where we really need to tackle antibiotic prescribing and stewardship. So we were very pleased to see that they included both of those groups. I think around a quarter or a third of the participants were children, young children, so that was very pleasing. They recruited people who had both ongoing health problems. So a particular group of concern for us in primary care are people with chronic lung disease, asthma, chronic pulmonary obstructive disease, and about a fifth of the patients had those problems. So that was also very pleasing. And in very broad terms, they told us they really liked using it. One of them sort of commented that they actually said, it didn't change my prescribing decisions, but I'd really like to see what the patients had. Now, we weren't able to really know whether prescribing decisions were being changed. That's the kind of the next big question. And to answer that question, we really do need to do this randomized controlled trial.
Right.
But in the interim, what we did ask them was, did it change your diagnostic certainty? And they reported to us that it did, and that was a statistically significant finding. So that's not a finding that can be explained by chance. Particularly, indeed more so when the test identified a microbe. So just having the test improved their certainty, even when the test was negative. But when the test result came back with a particular microbe detected, they were even more certain.
Well, that presumably that's key, right? That's what the whole point is, really.
Particularly if that means that they then believe that an antibiotic is less likely to be effective. Because right. That, of course, is the precursor to the important behaviour that we really want to influence, which is the issuing of a prescription, number one. And then ideally, we want patients to also, even if they do happen to have a prescription, or maybe they've got an antibiotic lying around in a cupboard that they think they might swallow, even if it's not been prescribed for this particular illness, if they also think that an antibiotic is less likely to be effective, then we're going to tackle the problem from the patient's perspective as well and reduce consumption.
Exciting, exciting. Wow. So this brings me to the whole issue of stewardship of antimicrobials, and two biggies to push you on. So as you would know, and it became arguably the most controversial of my review's recommendations, is that we actually recommended by the end of 2020, which is now obviously a time in the past, we believe the importance of exactly the kind of thing you've been researching should result in no developed countries prescribing antibiotics without a point of care diagnostic test. What do you now think about that kind of idea, especially having conducted this test? Is it pie in the sky, or is it a realistic goal that policymakers should be moving towards, et cetera, et cetera?
So I think there are two parts for me in my answer to that question. Number one is, what do we mean by a test? And I think the general public tends to think of a test as a swab that you then put in a machine and it gives you an answer. But I tend to think of tests as a little bit more broad than that. And I think that the doctor or the nurse that is assessing the patient is also effectively a test. And so the doctor or nurse is assessing that patient's symptoms. They are trying to make a diagnosis, and we've already talked about the limitations of that diagnostic process. But all of that, nonetheless, is a test. Now, for me, the big question is, does a point-of-care test like the one we've just been discussing add any further value to what those clinicians are already doing? And that's part of what a randomized controlled trial can assess. It can assess whether actually clinicians are already doing as well as they could be without this test.
Yeah.
But there's another element for me, which is that different doctors and nurses will work in different ways. It's quite idiosyncratic sometimes. You know, over a career of 20, 30, 40 years, clinicians develop their own rules of thumb. You know, I will always prescribe patient with X or Y. Now, another test, in my view, can be developed by systematizing that knowledge and establishing whether there are, in fact, particular symptoms and signs that clinicians can use that are useful to help them target prescribing. And one I'd really like to draw your attention to is a paper that we published three or four years ago now in Lancet Respiratory Medicine, where we try to do exactly that for the most common problem managed in primary care, which is children with respiratory infections. And we look to see whether the clinician's assessment could predict the child's illness deteriorating to the extent that they required hospital admission for their respiratory infection. And that's an outcome that clinicians really worry about, because if they don't prescribe and then the child is subsequently admitted to hospital, they end up feeling pretty bad about that. They may not need to feel bad because the admission might not have been preventable, but they're still going to feel pretty bad. And even worse, it might end up in medico-legal consequences. So it's, you know, the safest thing to do for a clinician is always just to prescribe. If you've got doubt, prescribe.
Classic problem.
So what we did was we looked at all the symptoms and signs that we could think of that might be important. And we did find that there were seven symptoms and signs that could reliably predict which children did not need subsequent admission to hospital. A group in whom they could be increased confidence that an antibiotic is probably not going to be necessary. And we're currently running a randomized controlled trial nationally to see whether that particular rule is effective. So just to summarize, I've kind of witted on a bit, forgive me, but you know, you asked me, is a test an ambitious, a reasonable ambition, the use of a test before every antibiotic is prescribed? I'd say yes, if we can use these so-called algorithms to predict which of the children or the patients most and least likely to benefit. Yes, that's already quite close to being ready. And there are some of those rules that are already in use and have been demonstrated to be effective. And then there's this second group, which are the, if you like, the high-tech end of the spectrum, the point-of-care tests, which can measure inflammatory response or can measure the presence of a microbe that may or may not add value to what the clinician's already doing.
Wow, this is very exciting. Very exciting. Fascinating. I can't come to an end without asking you the obvious. In your judgment, has the inappropriate use of antibiotics risen or declined as a result of COVID-19?
Well, I can offer you a small kind of glimpse of the UK perspective. Overall, prescribing has declined. And that's because the lockdown is completely indiscriminate. It halts the transmission of everything. So, you know, we are just, we've not had a flu season this year, thankfully. We've not had the bronchiolitis season, which usually is a pretty tough season for young children who get this very distressing, wheezing respiratory infection. Many of them end up in hospital. We've not had that. We are not seeing anywhere near the usual demand for care for respiratory and other infections in primary care. And I've talked to my, you know, talking to my secondary care colleagues, it's the same. They're not seeing the usual respiratory infections or other infections. So prescribing has thankfully fallen. There was this initial blip, which was really concerning, which is when we were first dealing with COVID and the first wave of it, and none of us knew what to expect, and none of us knew how to manage it. And there was various guidance flying around about, well, you must prescribe, and you must prescribe fairly, you know, heavy-duty Domestos-type antibiotics just in case. And I think there was an early blip that kind of really was inappropriate. And then, thankfully, NICE grasped the bull by the horns and issued some guidance that was very sensible and just said, look, you know, you don't need to prescribe antibiotics routinely for this. It's a virus. You know, if there's evidence of superimposed bacterial infection, fine, but for the vast majority of people, it's not necessary. And I think that's held sway largely.
That's very relieving to hear. Fascinating. So the obvious last question for somebody in my peculiar position, in addition in thanking you and your team for persisting with this, what I regard as fundamentally game-changing research to the whole problem is, what can I do to help get attention on this wonderful piece you've published beyond having this chat with you? And what more do I need to do to promote the case for primary care point of care testing?
Okay, well, thanks for that offer, Jim. That's so welcome. And I think having this conversation and maybe being willing to continue this conversation would be a great thing.
Please do. I'm very excited. It's been a pleasure having this chat with you.
Thank you so much, Jim, and thank you so much for taking, you know, some time. I know you're a busy chap.